I'm here today with Dr. Mahmoud Mohamedou, who is the head of the Regional Capacity Development Program at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, as well as visiting professor at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Thank you for speaking to the Global Observatory today. I wanted to ask you about the situation currently in Syria, and in particular the progress made by the regime of Bashar al-Assad in the last few months. I wanted to start off by asking you at what stage we're at right now in relation to the conflict and the progress that we have seen that the Assad regime has made.
I think there's an immediate, shall we say, narrative of the developments on the ground, the tactical, the military reality. Undeniably, on that front, over the past couple of months, shall we say, since the beginning of 2013, the regime has certainly been able to make some advances. We see that even in the communication and how they've been able to kind of bank on that and more media appearances by Bashar al-Assad. This is primarily due, undeniably, to the involvement of Hezbollah, who has now been overtly engaged in that and bringing their own expertise, which is, as the Washington Post called them a couple of years ago, the best guerrilla force in the world. And clearly there is a sense of that involvement making a change, particularly with the Battle of Al-Qusayr a few weeks ago. But that also taking place simultaneously with a certain degeneration in the level of the violence that we've seen quantitatively with the numbers. According to the United Nations, we're beyond 100,000 killed, which is a lot. And in terms of the gravity of the violations, and we've seen some gruesome scenes over the past couple of months. So clearly those are the dynamics that we see emerging. There's a certain evolution that is arresting because about a year and a half ago, the regime was far more on the defensive and the rebels were making advances, not only in Aleppo, but elsewhere in the frontiers and the borders by Iraq and Turkey in particular. Now, if we take a step back, as I think we should, we see also something else we should always keep in mind, which is the inherent relationship of the Syrian situation with the larger post-Arab Spring development in the area, the Middle East and North Africa. And that element is revealing in terms of the transnational dynamics, the presence of foreign fighters, which has been documented, the political logic behind any development taking place in, say, Syria, to those in Egypt, and even all the way into Libya and Tunisia. There's a certain correspondence and echoing that is always there, in spite, of course, of the fact that we have local domestic stories taking over gradually. But when you see, for instance, Bashar al-Assad making a statement about the failure of political Islam when Mohamed Morsi is taken out by the military, he's clearly looking at his own domestic front while at the same time using a regional development. And I think those two dimensions we should always keep in mind. The Middle East and North Africa is at a key moment historically, which is based on fluidity, characterized by a lot of interconnectedness. And I think for the current phase, even though we have seen those advances by the regime, in the longer term, they don't necessarily mean much in terms of the volatility of the situation.
I was wondering, while we're on this topic, whether we can make any comparison with the events in the 1990s in Algeria, given that actually the number of dead are somewhat comparable. Even I would say that the numbers are unfortunately growing more steadily in the case of Syria. Is this purely anecdotal, or do you think there are features that are shared?
No, you make a good point. And the numbers in Algeria, by the way, were 150,000 to 200 by the end of the civil war in 97, 98. I think there's a lot of analogies that we can bring to bear to this. And we can look at the civil war in Lebanon, paradoxically, which had been invaded by Syria in 1975, as another referential and elsewhere. I think the Syrian crisis has this particular characteristic, which is that it simultaneously encapsulates and brings to life, in terms of analogies, everything that the Middle East and North Africa has lived through over the past couple of decades, more or less the past 30 years, disappearance of Saddam Hussein, the failure of the Ba'ath system, and keep in mind that Syria is a Ba'ath system to begin with, the forays of the United States in the region, the Algerian story, as you mentioned, the whole more recent transformation in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia as well, at the same time that it takes us, and I really believe this is key, into new uncharted territory. And by that, I mean that we're seeing the transnational dynamic, the grammar of international relations, which has as a central feature today transnationality, being taken into a new territory through Syria. We see it with foreign fighters coming from all over the world, as one example. We see it with the fluidity of the development with, for instance, one non-state actor from another country, i.e. Lebanon Hezbollah, battling a series of globally oriented radical Islamists who initially are coming to support a peaceful process against an autocratic regime. You see how complex these dynamics are with each one of these militaries, for instance, the Lebanese military standing on the lines when this is happening, as well as other countries in the region. So we have this kind of confusing scene where the past we have to look at to see what logic led to this, but at the same time keep an eye on the new developments.
On the subject of Al-Qaeda, on the subject of the jihadist groups, this is an area in which you have published a book, particularly on Al-Qaeda, and I wanted to ask you about, it has come as a somewhat of a surprise to some observers of Syria, given that Syria was primordially a secular Arab state. Now, what relevance do you give to these groups? How much do you think they have taken Syria hostage?
It's very interesting because, again, we're in the new and old sort of interaction. Saddam Hussein's Iraq felt the same situation as well when Zarqawi emerged with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then we saw how that morphed. The situation should not be surprising. Al-Qaeda, the mother Al-Qaeda, has in effect kind of been becoming an evanescent type of organization since the mid to late 2000s, even before the death of bin Laden. By embracing the franchise model, they were in a way kind of creating a monster of their own, having these franchises becoming independent. And of course, symbolically, the death of bin Laden sort of sealed that process as such. What we see subsequently is a lot of autonomization of the franchises, particularly we heard a lot about the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Qaeda, of course, in the Islamic Maghreb. But little did we pay attention to what was happening with the continuing activity of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which gradually and steadily continuing its operations, even re-emerging post-2010, to the point that it was poised then to go to any new front in the making. And the new cause célèbre of those fighters became very quickly Syria. Not necessarily because of the opposition to secular, as you point out, Ba'athi Syria, which was the opposition of the peaceful opposition, shall we say, but because the transitional nature of the situation, the volatility and the absence of the state in most of these territories gave them an opportunity to recreate kind of the same patterns that we saw in the early 80s in Afghanistan or more recently in the Sahel or elsewhere. Such organizations live and die on that volatility, that absence of the state, and Al-Qaeda had that chance. Now, what's interesting, and this is, I think, the most important point, is that we're seeing a potential rebirth of Al-Qaeda global, shall we say, through a franchise. And that's an interesting development where you see that the periphery is created and then generates, shall we say, intensity back onto the center. And now you see Ayman al-Dawahiri almost fighting to be heard by his own franchise that he had put in place 5-6 years ago with bin Laden before his death.
Now in Syria, the word of the day is sectarianism, and even across the Middle East. Do you think that beyond the sectarianism between Christians and Muslims, between Sunni and Shiite, do you think that the real meta-narrative is between secular and religious?
It's undeniably one of the central ones. I think we don't have to beat around the bush. The Sunna-Shia element is clearly something that is central to the conflict going on. And it's taking us into irrational violence that is going to feed onto each other, because that's unfortunately how human nature has historically dealt with these processes, which will make a national reconciliation process where identity, ethnicity, religion, kin, brethren, tribe, all of these issues, and we have to go all the way to Ibn Khaldun to understand the importance of this in the region, all of this will have to be put on the table to be addressed. But it's only one of several other issues. Initially, you only have a basically citizenry state opposition, the interface that begins in Daraa. Then you also have the political dimension, which is the secular against the sort of the religious element, something we see playing out also with instability in Egypt, in Tunisia. And then you have also kind of the more regionally oriented narrative that seeks to address a colonial defect situation, addressing the French mandate and earlier with the Kurdish issue, which had not been dealt with, to something that is more internationally grounded into these processes that meet regularly in Doha and elsewhere as such. We have a multi-layered, complex crisis that is bringing all of these elements to some sort of non-resolution as of today.
Now, moving on to the attempts by the international community to intervene and to reach some sort of solution, and touching on the fact that the Syrian opposition that is mostly living in the diaspora is considered to be proverbially fragmented and divided, and how that is preventing any sort of serious intervention in the conflict. And given the strength at the same time that the Syrian regime has been displaying, do you think that that is going to be the narrative for the foreseeable future? Do you think that that is going to be the case in terms of continued fragmentation and failed attempts to intervene? And at the end of the day, a failure to find any alternative to the Assad regime as a dissuasion from any sort of intervention?
No, I don't think so. I think that ultimately we will have a wake-up call inevitably by the Syrians when it comes to this. However, for the time being, clearly the failure of that opposition, we have to call a spade, has not only given momentum to the regime who's able to bank on that, and even give the semblance of some sort of unity, paradoxically and ironically, that very regime that itself was facing a lot of disarray and disunity about a year and a half ago when it comes to that. But there's two issues here. On the one hand, we have an operational problem in relation to a coalition which is all the time being expanded with a variety of groups which have challenges which are not unprecedented. The Libyans dealt with this with the NTC 2 years ago. Other systems have to deal with this in Eastern Europe in the 90s and before that in Latin America, with all kind of coalition making, alliance, pact making being an important component of these rupturas pactadas that they were called at the time in Latin America and elsewhere. So that has to be addressed, and the pattern of resignations by several of these heads of the opposition is undeniably problematic. But the opposition, as I was saying, has also to deal with the competition by the radical Islamists. First of all, the Islamists amongst themselves, which are a fringe, which are democratic Islamists. We have to also recognize the fact that that line of activity exists, but also more radical ones, and we've seen the excesses of some of them last year and the brutality and the barbarity that was portrayed in some of those videos. That is more problematic because it's painting a challenge to what type of post-Assad Syria is going to be. And we have to look into that. The divisions have to be dealt with today in some sort of platform, the so-called day-after logic, so that they're not transplanted immediately onto the transition once Assad goes.
I was wondering whether, in relation to this particular point of the extreme violence, you see a sort of contagion effect in that in the most recent events in Egypt and the levels of brutality that are beginning to be reached there, massacres by each of the sides, do you think that there could be this chain reaction provoked by these videos, these images, etc., that is actually allowing or permitting or fostering levels of violence that are unprecedented?
Well, that's a very important point, and it's not limited to the violence. The Arab Spring and the post-Arab Spring is taking place in the globalization era. It's taking place into the YouTube, iPhone, technology revolution. It's not taking place as other transitions took place. And so you have this empowerment at the level of individuals that are able to beam any signal anytime. And therefore, when you connect that with the existing cultural commonality of a region that speaks the same language, follows each other on Al Jazeera and other channels, and echoes these dynamics at the same time that each story is becoming increasingly individual, that's fundamental. But you have a sense of keeping an eye or an ear onto what's happening elsewhere. And certainly, one sees the importance of the strife in Egypt. The negativity that is oozing out of that is undeniably making resolution of Syria even more complicated, as it's also impacting the debate ongoing in Tunisia, which is of another order, of a different logic, much less violent, but is increasingly becoming radicalized, pitting other sides. I think this notion of a singular narrative of the Arab Spring, quote-unquote, is always going to be somehow linked with this lifeline onto the domestic stories for the foreseeable future. And the more positive come, let's say, a precedent. If the Tunisian precedent, for instance, functions and indicates a way out of this, I think this will beam back onto Egypt and down the road into Syria.
Lastly, is there a single narrative for the Arab Spring? That is to say, is the Arab Spring a unique historical phenomenon, or do you think that we can learn from past historical experiences?
Well, thank you, because I have strong views on this. I really believe that there is no exceptionalism to the Arab Spring. We have new characteristics, the transnational dimension that we mentioned, which is a feature of early 21st century IR, international relations grammar, which is a fact, an important one, dynamics related to social media, which were not there in previous transitions, the involvement of the communities within a region that had been, up until the Ottoman Empire, a series of provinces connected by one power. All of those elements are there and making an impact. However, the more we indulge this argument of the exceptionalism of the Middle East and North Africa, shall we say the Arab or the Muslim one, the more we go into Orientalist, a neo-Orientalist territory. And I say this that it goes even for the processes within the region, that we analysts and actors as well have to embrace the notion of the latest type of political transitions. The Arab Spring is nothing but that. Those challenges took place elsewhere earlier in Latin America of the 70s, in southwestern Europe of the 60s as well, Portugal, Spain, Greece. We have the same logic in Eastern Europe in the early 2000s and late 90s and late 80s. We have these types of discussions that have to be dealt with. I think that today, to understand the politics and to act on them in the region, one needs to know more about alliance making, constitution drafting, pact making than about the Sykes-Picot Treaty.
Dr. Mahmoud Mohamedou, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.